thinking about that further, that poses some interesting ideas that the layering starts with aluminum, then goes to copper, and then goes to iron. So here's my idea of how Tesla's trimetal generator works. I'm going to retain the idea that William Lyon promoted of a reciprocating piston, and I always kind of wondered or speculated to myself, but kind of quietly because I couldn't do anything with it, that the piston alone, or the piston itself, was made of aluminum. So let's keep that. So the piston is being driven by pneumatic air from liquefied tanks of air, and because of the special valve, which I haven't studied, I haven't bothered to look it up, that Tesla had invented, along with his liquefaction of air, or slightly beforehand, around the 1895 period, when he lost his documentation to go to the patent office and patent it, and Mr. Linde, L-I-N-D-E, of Germany, went and patented it immediately after the lab fire destroyed all his documentation. So the piston is aluminum driven by pneumatic air, and it doesn't matter if it rotates. Scratch that from prior thinking, because I think I've written that on the energetic forum. It just goes back and forth, 16th of an inch, just like William Lyon says. Now, the tube it's in is copper. And what is copper for? It's the standard conventional wisdom material for all electrical conductors because it's cheap, cheaper than silver, even though silver has less resistance. But copper has less resistance than aluminum, and it has less resistance than iron. And since we make our wire for megahertz range audio systems for automobiles, in the megahertz range, copper clad aluminum, I'm going to put the aluminum piston inside of a copper tube. Now, I'm going to connect. This tube is cylindrical. It's a dipole. It is not tubular. Because now I'm going to take the two ends of that tube and connect it to a copper wire that I'm going to wind around the tube itself. Okay? A bare copper tube wound with wire connected to itself from either end. That makes a circular path. Now I'm going to put a load, a parallel circuit that will connect into that wire, that will go to the load. And because the piston oscillates, or reciprocates, I should say, oscillate in a reciprocating fashion, I'm going to expect the load is going to be supplied by an AC current coming off of that coiled wire. Now I'm going to put that coiled tube with the reciprocating piston inside a magnetic field, a permanent magnet, probably horseshoe-shaped, probably two horseshoes on either side, maybe multiple, maybe more than two, maybe six, maybe eight, coming from all different angles, because remember, this is a cylinder, which could be thought of as the center of a circular radial fashion in which I could point pairs of, or odd number, maybe it's not a pair, maybe it's not an even number. It should be probably a quadrature at the minimum, but it could be six. It could be... Oh, I see what I'm thinking. No, it would be eight for four phase. Yeah, it has to be paired U-shaped magnets with the north and the south pole at either end of the tube. And I suppose... Well, I don't know. I suppose the paired U-shaped magnet on the opposite side of the cylinder would have an opposite pole, so that the north pole of one end of one U-shaped magnet, horseshoe magnet, would be matched to the south pole of opposing side of the tube, completely parallel with those two ends at the end. And that's at one end of the tube, and then the other end of the tube would be an inverted pair of north and south poles. I'm just guessing, rather than two norths facing each other and two souths. And yet, actually, no, that makes more sense. Because that way the tube has a dipole status. Yeah, that makes more sense. So, you position the U-shaped horseshoe magnet such that the north leg of one and the north leg of the other are on the same end of the copper tube. And then the two south poles of those two U magnets are at the opposite end of the copper tube. And so now we can add in as many of these permanent magnets as we like to create a radial circular array surrounding the cylindrical tube. Now we have a dipole. and we have a reciprocating action within a dipole that starts out electrostatic because of the nature of the aluminum. It goes straight to an electric field picked up by the copper tube and then transferred through the copper winding surrounding the copper tube. But we now have a magnetic field surrounding that arrangement in the shape of a dipole. North pole is facing each other, south pole is facing each other at the two ends of the tube. Now, this is where the neat part comes in. What happens when we have thermal solar collectors on the roof of our home? We have to take the heat off as quickly as possible and send it to a heat reservoir down underground and underneath our home or in the walls of the home. Wherever we put it, we have to get it out of those thermal collectors or else they're going to reach saturation. And then they're going to fail to soak up any more heat. And so the sun is still beating down on them, and yet they're not absorbing any more heat. So we got to have a very efficient heat pump to take the heat away from them, and then a very big reservoir underground to store whatever quantity of heat we want to last us through the night or several days of cloudy days, to be able to run our various heat engine-driven engines or our heating for our home or hot water tank, whatever it happens to be, cook our food. So it's all about the heat pump at that point, not just the amount of heat that's being applied to the thermal collectors, solar panels on the roof. These are not electrical solar panels. These are thermal solar panels, you know, like hot water panels. So this is where the iron comes into the picture. It is not to take away heat, as William Lyon speculated. It is to take away magnetic force. Because here we've got these magnets that otherwise would be pointing their magnetic fields directly at the tube. We don't want that. We have to connect somewhere, and I'm not sure where, somewhere located on each U-shaped magnet, one or more places. It might require more than one position on each magnet. Connect to the iron hull of the electro-U-boat. Because we know that iron acts as a magnetic shield not because it reflects magnetism, but because it absorbs it and acts as a waveguide for it, redirecting it through its geometry of however the iron is shaped, so that now the iron is going to have a magnetic field instead of the permanent magnets. Now, they're still putting it out, but no sooner than they put it out, it gets sucked up by the iron. And the more iron, the more it gets sucked away from them more efficiently. And this is the secret, is to take is to produce a magnetic field, and no sooner than you produce it, get rid of it. So you set it up as if you're bombarding the cylindrical field, but then you take it away. And what happens when you take away a magnetic field? What are you left with? An electric field. But it's generated by a permanent magnet, which requires no cost of energy to create that electric field. And we couldn't have done it from a permanent magnet unless we had taken the magnetic field strength away from the magnets in a direction opposite, away from the cylinder, the cylinder with the reciprocating pistons, in a direction opposing it, away from it. So this is what we do. And it's so simple. But that's all there is to it. And the more iron you add, the more efficiently you can take away the magnetic field from the permanent magnets and create that electric field from permanent magnets, which you normally wouldn't get. You normally would get a magnetic field pointing at the cylinder, but we want an electric field there. And we want a north pole on one side and a south pole on the other, so that when the pistons are reciprocating, they go inside that electric field and they pump an electric current through the wire, because they're pumping it through the copper tube and hence into the wire, a reciprocating AC electric current initiated by aluminum pistons but captured by the copper tube and carried through the copper winding surrounding the tube and then amplified by an electric field produced by permanent magnets who have had their magnetic field sucked out of them in a direction away from the cylinder, the reciprocating cylinder, towards the hull of the vessel. Now, in terms of the picture that William Lyne has in the back of his book, we just swap. We do a one-to-one substitution between the hull, the so-called resonant cavity that William Lyne wanted to assume, and we'll retain that for momentarily without really dealing with it yet, is the shell, the chassis of that pneumatically driven special generator. But now that's been transferred to the hull of the U-boat. So it's much bigger, more massive, and more efficient. And of course it's supported by the weight of the ocean pressing down on it, so you don't have to worry about the weight of the iron, because if anything, well, yeah, iron will sink, that's true, without the air inside to buoy the vessel. But you don't have to worry about support. You know, how do you support all that massive iron? It's supported by the water, because the air inside is buoying it up from the bottom of the ocean deep, and so you've got this buoyancy counterbalanced with the water, meaning that the two forces, the buoyancy of the air inside the vessel and the water outside, is what gives support to the iron. So you don't have to worry about a supporting armature to support all that massive iron, because that's a lot of iron that you got to worry about supporting it. How do you do that? Well, in a submarine vessel, it's done for you. All you have to do is, you know, do what you normally do, create a submarine and stick it in the water. And it's so perfect because they have liquefied air, so they have all the air they need. They don't even have to surface for quite some time. It not only drives their engine, their motor, their generator, excuse me, the generator, and the generator, of course, drives all the electricity for the vessel, including the electric motors, but they also got all that free oxygen in the form of liquefied air. It's a perfect setup. What could be more handy-dandy perfect than that? No fancy-schmancy crystal oscillators, no need to invoke anything outside the technology of its day, which is approximately 70 years ago, 70, 80 years ago. So we're talking really ancient technology here. Nothing really far-fetched. All analog, nothing digital, yet it's a perfect setup because we want electricity. We don't want magnetism. What are we going to do with magnetism? It's nothing to do with a magnet motor or anything of the sort. It's all about an electric field started by an electrostatic charge driven by the aluminum pistons, but ultimately it's all about electricity and an electric field. Yet, the enigma, the mystery, is what the heck does iron's got to do with this? Iron is magnetizable. It didn't make any sense to me. And the watt-hour meter has a permanent magnet in it in the form of a braking magnet. And I thought, well, gee, that sucks. That's kind of weird. Wouldn't we want to remove that, demagnetize it? Boy, was I wrong. When you attach iron to a permanent magnet, it has a very specific property to it. But I didn't think that was part of it. That was the last thing on my mind. So finally, I think I figured out how to think properly on this subject, and it's all because I got my mind now saturated with how to think about the trimetal generator in terms of the three gunas and the three doshas and how the three doshas emanate from the interactions of the gunas with each other such that the doshas are a mirage. They are beat frequencies or harmonics off of the three gunas. They are not anything of substantial merit. They are a reverb effect, a result of the three gunas interacting with each other. But this is really the way to look at it. With the proper understanding of the three gunas and the three doshas, now I can take the knowledge of the watt-hour meter, apply it to the story that William Lyne gives us about Tesla's trimetal generator, and do a proper analysis of how I would construct that special generator with absolutely no expertise behind me other than the knowledge of the three gunas. That's it. If you know about the three gunas and you know how they map with to the three metals employed, then the rest is automatic. There's nothing more to figure out. I mean, you just do it, you know? Make it happen. What more need be said? So there you go. And go and run with it and play. Because I don't need to go there. I mean, I suppose I could. You know, I suppose anybody could. That's the secret of Tesla. Why they have to keep Tesla's technology so secret is because it's so simple. Any high school professor in a science class could have a high school project and have his class fabricate just about anything of Tesla's. You know, I mean, sure, some of it's dangerous, but some of it's not dangerous, and it's all simple. Well, some of his stuff is actually a little more complicated. This is actually quite simple, and that's why I latched onto it. I felt like it was simple. But simple in a way that I could probably be able to grapple with eventually. And it's only been, what, since August? So what is this? September, October, November, December, January. 5 months. In 5 months, I figure it out? Oh, God. Anyway, I put myself to it in a very specific way. And, of course, I'm not going to get into that because I've already covered that. So, there you go. J. Guru Dev. Maharishi has said that the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita has said that Krishna says to Arjuna, you do not have control over actions. You do not have control over the effects of action. You only have control over action alone. But the fruits of action are outside your reach. Okay, so what does that mean? That means the doshas are outside your reach, but the gunas are within your reach. So take care of action, he says, and let the fruits take care of itself. Well, the doshas are not real. They're an illusion. They're the effect of the gunas interacting with each other. Yet, when we go to take a pulse diagnosis of somebody in Ayurvedic medicine, you look for the doshas. You don't look for the gunas. In fact, you never hear about the gunas in Ayurvedic medicine. You hear always about the doshas. And I guess it's because it's so complicated and convoluted, the way that gunas interact with each other, is that you're never going to find them in a pure state anyway. They're constantly interacting, creating all these mixtures, and the mixtures are the doshas themselves. I guess that's the only way to explain it, I suppose. But there you are. The Gita's telling us how to view the doshas and the gunas, and I was not paying attention.